Our story of Jim Thorpe continues. The story of Olympic gold medals won and lost, of an incredible career in professional baseball and football, which inevitably came to an end. In his later years, Jim Thorpe struggled to find work. Coaching jobs he dreamed of somehow never materialized. He had stints as a bouncer, security guard, and ditch digger, and he finally wound up in Hollywood, mostly playing American Indian chiefs in westerns. He did get to see a biopic made of his life, starring Burt Lancaster.
Think you can do it right, Pat? Just give me that ball.
Working, sweating, training to go to the Olympics. For what?
But by then he had slipped into alcoholism, and he died destitute in 1953. At which point, as we heard, his third wife shows up at the funeral, kidnaps his body, and sells it to a small town in Pennsylvania for use as a tourist attraction. There just aren't words. Jim's children and the Sac and Fox Nation took the town to court and demanded his body be returned to his homeland for a traditional burial, as he'd requested.
How did the town of Jim Thorpe, Pennsylvania, respond?
This is Suzanne Harjo again.
Like stuck pigs.
We have no intentions of letting him go. There's no reason for it.
They really did not respond graciously at all. They said, he's ours, we bought him fair and square.
And has the town made money off of this, as far as you know, after all these decades?
I do not know. I would imagine they have, because they fought tooth and nail to keep him there. He's their trophy. This is a time-dishonored practice in America, taking native body parts and bodies and capturing them and somehow parading them. But I know that after a lot of our massacres and our people were mutilated, and we're still recovering parts of our relatives, our ancestors, from this kind of practice.
You said this is a big deal, this whole story of the push, the move, the campaign to return Jim Thorpe's remains to tribal lands in Oklahoma. Why is this such a big deal about Jim Thorpe in particular?
Until 1989, when we got the repatriation laws that we started working on in 1967, by the way, we were considered under law the archaeological resources of the United States of America. And we wanted to change that. We wanted to humanize ourselves like the rest of the world. We've had the horrors of grave robbing and of people being taken out of their graves after being freshly buried and being beheaded, and then their bodies just left there. I mean, that happened under the color of law, under the Indian crania study of the U.S. Army Surgeon General of the late 1800s. I mean, there's a whole raft of Army officer reports, written reports in the National Anthropological Archives. One of them said, I waited until the cover of darkness, till the grieving family left the graveside, exhumed the body and decapitated it. Now, what they would do is take the head, measure the skull, weigh the brain, and then dip the whole thing in lye.
Wow.
Note the measurements and send it as freight to Washington, to the Army Surgeon General, or depending on what year it was, the Army Medical Museum and the Smithsonian. Imagine the people coming back to that graveside the next day and finding their beheaded, headless loved one outside the grave. I mean, what would you think?
No, it's absolutely horrible. I mean, it's so horrible. You can't even imagine that.
It's like a scene from a horror movie, except it really happened. America's genocidal war against indigenous people is one of history's worst atrocities, on a scale so massive, it's hard to wrap your mind, let alone your heart, around. That's why David Marinus wanted to write Jim Thorpe's biography. Because, as he told Shannon, sometimes it's the small details of history that can open up a bigger truth and help you take it in. For example,
I knew that he went to the Carlisle Indian Industrial School, but I didn't really know the story of what those boarding schools did. The first set of Native Americans who went there were Lakota Sioux. These kids thought they were going there to die, to show their bravery. Mm-hmm. And many of them did, in fact, die. And when I'm doing a book, I'm always looking for those moments that sort of wash over, history washes over me. And that happened at Carlisle when I went to what is still the cemetery there for those Indian children, and there are 186 of them still there.
Wow. So the cemetery's there, and you can read their names on the...
Absolutely. You know, sometimes it's the name that the school gave them, and sometimes it's their native name. Only in the last several years have some of those children been repatriated to their homelands. It's run by the U.S. military now. It's the Army War College. And for decades, the War College was not allowing that. But now, finally, some repatriation is going on, and some of the children are being repatriated to their homelands.
Which is all Jim Thorpe's family is asking for him. For his body.
The public, the world had Jim Thorpe all his life. He was a public figure, and the family just had one role, and that was at the end to carry out his wishes and to do it in the way that he would have been proud to have done for someone else.
The battle to reclaim Jim Thorpe's body has a long legal history. His family won the right to get his body back in a U.S. district court, but a federal appeals court sided with the town and reversed the decision. The Thorpe family petitioned the U.S. Supreme Court, but it refused to hear the case. And so now, the only way Jim Thorpe's body will ever be returned to his homeland is if the town of Jim Thorpe, Pennsylvania, does so voluntarily.
What do you think will happen? I mean, do you think Jim Thorpe's remains will eventually return to Sac and Fox tribal lands?
I do. I do, because great things can't happen in that spot.
You're talking about the people in Jim Thorpe, Pennsylvania.
I am. I think at some point the younger people are going to say, I don't know what our parents and grandparents and their parents were thinking, but we can still be Jim Thorpe, Pennsylvania, but we don't have to hold on to his remains. Why do we have to hold him like he's a prisoner of war or a trophy?
The thing that I find so, I don't know, remarkable about this history that you're describing is you've been working on these issues for years, for decades. You keep going. You don't give up, even when things probably look kind of hopeless. And I guess I sort of wonder, you know, how do you manage to carry on and keep fighting to restore your rights and the good name and all of that?
Well, it's my job to be optimistic. I'm Cheyenne and Hodelgi Muskogee. And for the Cheyenne people, an instruction was provided to the people as a whole that the nation shall be strong so long as the hearts of the women are not on the ground. And what that means is that we have a job to be optimistic. We have a job to do a job, to get things done, and to believe that it will be done eventually because we're going to work to make it so.
I hope you know. you've always been the one. I hope you know.
I think in a larger sense, the issue that I dealt with as a biographer is this a tragedy? And I decided that there were tragic elements to it, but that it wasn't. It was a story of perseverance. You know, how do you judge a life? How do you view a life? My late brother used to say that life is a series of sensations. And I sort of understand that. And Thorpe had some fabulous sensations throughout his life. So that's not tragic. I mean, you just think about all the people he encountered in his life, starting with playing football against Dwight Eisenhower with Omar Bradley on the bench, going to the Olympics with George S. Patton, playing baseball with Christy Mathewson, traveling the world with Hall of Famers Tris Speaker and Sam Crawford, going out to Hollywood and acting with Bob Hope and being in a movie directed by Michael Curtiz, who directed Casablanca, and having Burt Lancaster play him. I mean, you know, I think he had a lot of amazing sensations in his life and also some very difficult periods. And he did struggle with alcohol. He had 7 children, 3 wives, often didn't see his children as he was traveling around the country. So there were some elements of tragedy to it, and also some amazing, unparalleled sensations.
Jim Thorpe means to me that phrase we call indigenous excellence, embodying the human spirit in all our flaws, but still being legendary and great, and not allowing all the things that go against us in life to tear us down and stop us from being our greatest version of ourselves. That's what Jim Thorpe represents to me.
I think for such a long time, Native people and Native communities have been defined by our deficiencies. We're poor, you know, if you look at educational attainment, we're at the bottom of the list. There's always somebody trying to take our land or our children, or it's always what's wrong with us. And over the past 20 years, I think as treaty rights have been asserted successfully in courts, and there's been this renewal of culture and language, especially in Native America, I think people are starting to understand that, yeah, we've got generational trauma, but generational trauma didn't help us survive. We survived because of generational joy and ingenuity and innovation and achievement. And I think there's probably nobody that better describes that than Jim Thorpe.
I'm Ann Strainchamps, and this is To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'd like to thank our guests today for sharing their knowledge and their hearts. Rapper Tall Paul's album is called The Story of Jim Thorpe. Go to Spotify and check it out. Tall Paul is an Anishinaabe and Oneida hip-hop artist enrolled on the Leech Lake Reservation in Minnesota. Biographer David Marinus, author of A Path Lit by Lightning, The Life of Jim Thorpe. Activist Suzanne Schoen Harjo is the recipient of a 2014 Presidential Medal of Freedom. She's Cheyenne and Hodolgi Muskogee. And Professor Patty Lowe, director of the Center for Native American and Indigenous Research at Northwestern University. She's a member of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior, Ojibwe. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio. Charles Monroe Kane produced this hour, with help from Angelo Bautista, Shannon Henry Kleiber, and Mark Rickers. Our technical director and sound designer is Joe Hartke, with help from Sarah Hopeful. Additional music this week comes from Tall Paul, Randy Wood, Superman, Ketza, and Audio Res Out. Steve Paulson is our executive producer, and I'm Ann Strangehamps. If you heard anything in today's show that mattered to you, I hope you'll share it. Be well, and thanks for listening. Never see the families again. Never again.